Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. I know, folks, that there are all sorts of, I'll just say, train wrecks, just, you know, deplorable things that are happening. It's not going to get any better. If we don't start focusing on fixing our government and getting them into compliance, they're going to make it worse. They're only doing things to make it worse. And so we can't necessarily trust them to actually solving the problem. I can't emphasize this enough. And by the way, welcome back, Paul. We've got Paul Venable with us. But I just want to share this because it seems like I cannot not get engaged anymore and basically point out that our real problem is we the people. We're the ones that are not holding them accountable. You know, we have everything at our availability. It's at our disposal to hold them accountable. And because we're not holding them accountable, we're just complaining, then what good is that doing? Folks, just keep doing what you're doing.
And we'll keep what we're getting.
Right. So, and actually, I had a detailed conversation, just to go down a little rat hole. I had a detailed conversation yesterday with a gentleman that is actually running to become a state chair. And we talked about the statistics, it's worth mentioning because you happen to be the chair for Missouri for the Constitution Party. And right. So here's the interesting thing, because it was brought up this week. On Fox News, they were talking about how it's almost 20% of the Democrats are abandoning the Democratic Party right now. And wow. It's almost 10% of the Republican Party that's abandoning the Republican Party. So in other words, there's 30% of the uniparty that is defecting. But here's the thing. They're not really going towards the Constitution. They're just going to something different.
Right.
And that's an indictment, because the reason why they're not going to the Constitution Party or the Independent American Party, and I'm just, you know, not necessarily trying to take a swipe at, you know, at your party, Paul, because you happen to be one of the very few states, as far as the chairs in the party, that's actually, you know, climbing that mountain to get, you know, to get the party up on top, on, you know, onto full compliance with the Constitution. But none of the rest of the states are doing that. I mean, there's some talk about it. There's some, you know, I think there's hope there, but they're not there. They're not in the process of climbing and trying to lead on the Constitution. And so I see all of this. And what this is because I was talking to this gentleman who's running, and I basically laid it out. I said, look, you know, your brand has been ruined. It is being sullied constantly by the people who happen to bear the Republican name in office, and they're doing all sorts of terrible things. The rhino, just the fact that R in rhino is so common now that most people understand that is associated to the problem. And if you guys don't take the brand back, bottom line, here's the real problem. If the brand doesn't stand for full compliance of the Constitution, then you've got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so he agrees with me. But the problem is that when it gets down to the party players, and you understand this, I think, intimately, when you're dealing with leaders of the party, this is the old guard. They're not in the mood of changing their paradigms or, one, admitting they're wrong. Who wants to admit they're wrong? I've never met a person, you know, it takes a long time for them to finally realize I bought a lemon. You know, when they buy a car, and boy, this car has been nothing but problems for them. And they go, you know what, they're very slow to saying I bought a lemon, because what that means is I didn't do the due diligence, or I got taken advantage of, and nobody wants to admit that. Right? I mean, it's like, you know, it's like, look how stupid I am.
I got to tell you something, GR.
Sure.
I bought a lemon. My truck engine just died, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's going to cost me a few bucks. So I can admit it, but I'll tell you what, it hurts like the dickens.
It does. It does. Because we should know better. You know, if I mean, it's one thing if you're a kid and you make a mistake buying a car, but it's a costly mistake, but, you know, it's mistakes that are common for somebody that doesn't know. But the old guard, these guys know.
Yeah.
And they bought a lemon, and they're driving the lemon, and they still have yet to say, you know, this is a lemon. We need to abandon this. Anyway. Okay. Anyway. I digress. So we're in the North Carolina debates. One of the things I didn't get into, because my voice was really strained, was the rules of the convention and kind of like how they formed and everything else. Most people don't understand that the North Carolina delegates, they actually met twice. They met in, I want to say, July time frame in 1788, and they ended up reconvening in 1789, where they ratified, or I think they actually ended up, let me pull it up, I've got it. I think when I can actually tell you when they did ratify. And so go ahead, I'm sorry, what were you saying?
I said, while you're doing that, I'm sure you're going to give us some idea what was the cause of the big interruption.
Well, because they felt that it was the reason they couldn't pull the trigger is there was still enough sentiment towards maybe a Bill of Rights, that they needed to do something different. They couldn't pull the trigger on saying, yeah, this is what we need to do. And so it was November. They actually reconvened in the fall. And so, and actually, it was November of 89, a year and a half or a year and a quarter later.
Wow.
So it was after Congress had basically, at least the House of Representatives, had passed, and I believe it was after the Senate had passed the Bill of Rights and sent them out.
Okay.
And so that's when they said, okay, we now have a Bill of Rights. You know, what's our excuse now?
All right.
And so what we're reading are really the debates in the first convention. This is not the second convention. And so, and there probably is some administrative documents or what have you, where they finally met. And it may be at the end of this. I don't know. I've never looked for them. But because I'm only looking for how they defined the Constitution, because that's what's really important. The terms and definitions of the Constitution is really important. It's nice to have all of the details and connecting, you know, to have a complete story. I know everybody loves to have a complete story, but I think sometimes it's really important to know what we need right now to help us. You know, and so that's why I really do focus on, you know, that very specific, you know, the content that we need in defining the Constitution. So anyway, as we go back to where we were, let me see here. I think we were in the middle of Mr. Davey making some comments. Is that not correct? And I believe, what was his comments? Okay, right. So we're kind of in the throes of discussing slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of read the body of the paragraph, and so there's just this little bit that's left, and then there's Mr. Galloway who then makes a retort or a comment. So you want to go ahead and pick this up, or do you want to start off with Mr. Davies, you know, the full body of it again?
I don't know. Maybe you think it would help for context if I did?
Yeah, it does. So let's go ahead and take Mr. Gowdy's comment and then Mr. Davis. So it's all together. There we go.
Okay. All right. Slaves, Mr. Chairman. So Davy Gowdy. Okay, so we're starting from the beginning with slaves.
Right.
We covered a couple paragraphs, but we're going to do them again. Okay, so this is Mr. Gowdy.
Okay.
All right. Yes. on slaves. Mr. Chairman, this clause of taxation will give an advantage to some states over the others. It will be oppressive to the southern states. Taxes are equal to our representation. To augment our taxes and increase our burdens, our Negroes are to be represented. If a state has 50,000 Negroes, she is to send one representative for them. I wish not to be represented with Negroes, especially if it increases my burdens. Okay, so it sounds to me like he's saying, we should have all this representation. Then he says, I wish not to be represented with. Oh, I see what he's saying. I see what he's saying. Okay. We should have a representation for these Negroes, but not for me because I'm not one. That's what it sounds like he's saying.
That is correct. Yep.
Okay. It was Mr. Davey responds. Mr. Chairman, I will endeavor to obviate what the gentleman last up said. I wonder to see gentlemen so precipitate and hasty on a subject of such awful importance. It ought to be considered that some of us are slow of apprehension or not having those quick conceptions and luminous understandings of which other gentlemen may be possessed. The gentleman, quote, does not wish to be represented with Negroes, end quote. This, sir, is an unhappy species of population, but we cannot at present alter their situation. The eastern states had great jealousies on this subject. They insisted that their cows and horses be equally entitled to representation, that the one was property as well as the other. It became our duty, on the other hand, to acquire as much weight as possible in the legislation of the Union, and as the northern states were more populous in whites, this only could be done by insisting that a certain proportion of our slaves should make a part of the computed population. It was attempted to form a rule of representation from a compound ratio of wealth and population, but on consideration, it was found impracticable to determine the comparative value of lands or other property in so extensive a territory with criterion of representation. It was urged by the deputies of the eastern states that a representation of two-fifths would be of little utility, and that their entire representation would be unequal and burdensome, that in a time of war, slaves rendered a country more vulnerable while its defense devolved upon its free inhabitants. This is an interesting line. I think you addressed it yesterday, but that having slaves would make a country more vulnerable. What are they saying here? Is it that you don't know what the slaves may do? Their behavior may be unpredictable. They may even be incited to turn against you. I'm wondering if
So it's the last, what you just said, the latter. So if I am going to attack a nation and they have and are practicing slavery, it would be an advantage for me, a very strategic advantage, to basically come in and say, we're going to come in, we're going to basically subdue you, and we're going to free your slaves. Mm-hmm. Now I have a whole bunch of people that have some vested interest within that country to actually mm-hmm. rise up to help us.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Okay.
Okay, and that's definitely a disadvantage.
Oh, absolutely, okay. Yeah.
So Mr. Davey continues. On the other hand, we insisted that in time of peace, they contributed by their labor to the general wealth as well as other members of the community. That, as rational beings, they had a right of representation and in some instances might be highly useful in war. On these principles, the eastern states gave the matter up and consented to the regulation as it has been read. I hope these reasons will appear satisfactory. It is the same rule or principle which was proposed some years ago by Congress and assented to by 12 of the states. It may wound the delicacy of the gentleman from Guilford, Mr. Gowdy, but I hope he will endeavor to accommodate his feelings to the interests and circumstances of his country. Mr. Galloway then speaks up, said that he did not object to the representation of Negroes so much as he did to the fewness of the number of representatives. He was surprised how we came to have but five, including those intended to represent Negroes, that in his humble opinion, North Carolina was entitled to that number independent of the Negroes.
So in other words, he's challenging the estimate. But you got to remember that this was 1789 when the new government was going to form. And in 1790, there was going to be a new census, and then they would reapportion representation for Congress based on an accurate census.
Okay. So obviously that was in the back of their minds at the time.
Right, but you got to remember that when the Constitution was being written, North Carolina delegates were there looking at what the numbers were, and they said, okay, you know, based on 30,000, this is how much we based, and based on the census and the numbers that we have, this is the best we can do. Now, the real thing, you know, when you really look at the population, they talk about how the eastern and northern states and the new states that were forming, they were coming into the, you know, this union, bringing in two senators that were representing a free state, as well as more representatives in the House of Representatives representing a free state. In other words, anti-slavery. The abolition movement was truly growing. And so when you look at most of the states that were joining, even Tennessee, which was North Carolina, and Kentucky, because of the Northwest Ordinance, those states joined the Union, and they weren't slave states. They didn't declare themselves slave, but they didn't outlaw slavery because the Constitution didn't outlaw it.
Okay.
And so, okay, for the most part, because in 1789, in August 1789, Congress actually incorporated the Northwest Ordinance as a guide in admitting new states into the Union. Because going back to the states, the first state, which was, let me see here, it was Vermont, which was the one right at, so Rhode Island actually came in 1790. Vermont didn't come in as a new state in the Union, as the 14th state, until 1791.
Okay.
But it was a free state. Then Kentucky came in. And that was from Virginia. And, you know, Kentucky, they may have had slaves, but it wasn't a big plantation state like Virginia and the Carolinas. It had slavery. Yes, it did. But it was because it wasn't, there wasn't this division that you had to have slavery and that slavery was imposed. It was, you know, these were free states that were coming into the Union, not declaring either, but just, you know, acknowledging that you could. It wasn't illegal. And so then Ohio came in, and then Louisiana came in, and both of those were free states.
Louisiana was a free state?
Yes, it was a free state. Mm. It was French.
Oh, okay.
And it was French, even though it was Spanish before, but the French actually sold us that land, right?
Right.
Okay, so the Louisiana Purchase. And so it came into the Union. It was a free state, even though it did have some slavery, and slavery grew in it. Mm-hmm. And then Indiana joined, Mississippi, Illinois, Alabama, Maine. And so when Missouri was coming along, Missouri was going to be a hardcore free state. There was not going to be a lot of slavery in Missouri other than the few rich people that came in and planned to have these big plantations. And they realized that, you know, they may not be able to maintain their slavery, and that would really cramp their their entrepreneurial endeavors. Mm-hmm. And so this is why they went to political theatrics and went to the politicians at the federal level to get the federal government to mandate slavery. And that was where, because this is where we were really seeing the undoing of slavery based on that 1808 clause that was ending the slave trade. So we actually saw this coming, and I say this, that the Missouri Compromise is the manifestation of the truth that the Constitution was actually going to evolve this union to get rid of slavery.
In other words, they saw this and they knew it, and they wanted to do something about it.
Well, so they actually saw it, actually started getting manifested, and those who were heavily vested in slavery said, we have to do something about this, or we're going to lose this institution we depend on.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So now we move on to the next comment, and it's a ways down, and it is about common law, and this is kind of important, so go ahead.
Okay. There it is. Is this common law or common law and the militia?
So this is on page 29.
29? Uh-huh. Okay. I went too far.
Okay.
Oh, there it is. Common law.
Important.
Page 29. Okay. And this is Mr. Iredell.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, the objection would be right if there was no other mode of punishing. But it is evident that any officer may be tried by a court of common law. He may be tried in such a court for common law offenses, whether impeached or not, as it is to be presumed that inferior tribunals will be constituted. There will be no occasion for going always to the Supreme Court, even in cases where the federal courts have exclusive jurisdiction. Where this exclusive cognizance is not given them, redress may be had in the common law courts in the state, and I have no doubt that regulations will be made, as will be put it out in the power of officers to distress the people with impunity.
In other words, what you missed, though, you kind of mispronounced that.
Okay.
Such regulations will be made as will put it out of the power of officers to distress the people with impunity. In other
Thanks
words,
for clarifying.
Yeah, because the common law will actually protect the people from the officers or the public servants being able to, you know, do what they want to do and not be held accountable.
How will it do that?
Well, so in common law courts, you can actually, and this is a trial by jury with a common law grand jury. You can determine whether a person is violating their oath and exceeding their authorities.
Okay.
In other words, he's pointing to how common law is used as a check to verify. Because, see, they had the oath of office. You're supposed to support the Constitution. Well, they didn't have the right of petition. That was not, the Bill of Rights didn't exist. The language of the right of petition wasn't there. So what was the check that they were to use? Common law courts.
Oh, okay.
We can still use common law courts, but now we have the right of petition. And when we prove and we get a politician that refuses, they basically say, I don't care, you know, if you caught me with my pants down or not. I'm not stepping down. So what are the people to do if government won't enforce the laws, and government being these scoundrels, then mm-hmm. and we use these petitions, then that's why we have to take back the counties to restore our common law courts.
Okay, so in other words, our representatives, we're a representative form of government. It's not like back when you had a monarch. Okay, so our representatives have the authority to call forth a common law court.
Not right. And so, Paul, I hate to tell you this, Paul.
I'm the county level.
Pop, forgive me. I didn't realize this was coming. We were having this conversation, and now we've got this interruption. So we're going to go into a break, and we'll be right back after this Will Crick promo. We'll be right back, Paul. Thank you so much.
The The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I apologize for the not seeing the interruption coming, but this is really good. This is really important because, and what came to me, and the best way to really approach this, and if you don't mind, Paul, I'm going to play the devil's advocate. I'm actually going to play the evil guy here.
Okay.
If I want to really subvert this good land of liberty and justice and freedom for all, I have to convince the people not to use the tools that they have to defend themselves and actually keep me at bay. Mm-hmm. I have to get them to give up what those tools are and convince them that some things that actually have no bearing, have no ability to affect what I'm doing, so that they feel like they're doing something,
right?
But it has to no avail. It has no consequence, and so it's kind of like yelling at somebody. You may feel better, and unfortunately, you know, if you use corporal punishment, 9 times out of 10, corporal punishment really won't solve the problem. It doesn't really teach unless you're using it effectively. In other words, along with explaining why you're doing this, why you don't want to do this, and that the justice must be served, blah, with a little child, you know, slap their hands or what have you. And so when we actually are sitting, when we look at what government, you know, is doing, we have tools, very specific tools, and nobody's using them. I mean, this is what the show has been pointing out. We've been very forthright from the very beginning saying, hey, look, you know, the state should be holding the federal government accountable. The counties need to be holding the state accountable, and the people need to be holding the county accountable. I mean, right. We came to this conclusion a couple of years ago. And so, you know, and actually how to do all of this and how this all, you know, these are like dominoes that if we actually do these things, it will invoke Republic Review. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this came out in, you know, working with, because I saw what the NLA and other groups were doing. And I said, okay, let me get involved in this because what you're doing is good. And it's kind of right. I think this is what we need to do, but let's get it right. Right. And so, there's no doubt in my mind what we've got is right, right. I mean, getting people to use their First Amendment petitions and creating a movement is what has to happen. The people have to demand compliance. So when we kind of look at what he's talking about here, you know, he's actually pointing out that prior to the right of petition, because he's actually saying this kind of at the very beginning, I'm going to read back over this. He says, Mr. Chairman, the objection would be right if there was no other mode of punishing. But it is evident that an officer may be tried by a court of common law. He may be tried in such a court for common law offenses, whether impeached or not. In other words, and you don't have to impeach the person to hold them accountable to their oath. as it right. is to be presumed that inferior tribunals will be constituted, there will be no occasion for going always to the Supreme Court, even in cases where the federal courts have exclusive jurisdiction. So in other words, you know, it's not bypassing. It's mm-hmm. we actually have the jurisdiction and we can do this. The reason it gets into the appeals is because the culprit, the politician who demands their due process and appeal because they don't agree, they don't want to be punished. They want to be able to stay at the trough of power and to lap it up and to use it. And so this is how, you know, they appeal. So they stay in office through their appeals. And if they can get a more corrupt government to protect them, then great. This is the beauty, and the reason I'm diving into this and really dissecting this is because this is the beauty of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. Understanding this and getting, you know, the courts and the people to understand when you actually invoke Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, due process is not guaranteed. As a matter of fact, due process isn't even in play because Section 3 is about eligibility. That's why it says no senator or representative shall. So I'm going to pull it up because I want to read the actual language because it speaks to, you know, that this isn't necessarily a law. This actually speaks to an eligibility. It says no person shall be a senator or a representative in Congress or elector or hold any of these offices if while they're under oath. In other words, if you violate your oath of office, you can't be in the office anymore. It's an eligibility standard.
I'm ineligible.
Pardon me?
You become ineligible.
Ineligible, correct. You're no longer eligible to be in office. Absolutely. It says, that's why it says no person shall be. In other words, if you violate your oath, then you can't be this anymore. You're now ineligible. You have made yourself ineligible. So that's why this completely bypasses impeachment. And this is something that so many states have really failed to invoke. This is where, you know, these people that want to have these voter initiatives, if there's any initiative that needs to be done, it is actually, you know, invoking and giving the people the power to remove public servants based on the fact that they violated their oath and they are instantly made ineligible and they must be removed.
So let me ask you this. Maybe we have the power, we just don't have the process.
Well, so right now, so this is the law, is not what is stated in the Constitution, the supreme law of the land. So in other words, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, is that not a part of the supreme law? It must be enforced. Okay, so it must be enforced, but it's not.
Correct.
They're deliberately not enforcing it because it hurts them. They don't want to give up their power. They're doing everything they can. So going back to what I was saying when we came back from the break, playing the devil's advocate, if I really wanted to actually assume and take over and create a corrupt government, I have to get the people ignorant on the tools that they truly possess to keep me at bay.
Right.
And so what those tools are, this is the whole point here, folks. Those tools are first the oath, the legal binding oath of office. Second, the right of petition to, you know, redress the grievances of your public servants. If they're doing something they shouldn't do, you have a right to petition them and challenge them and point out that if they don't do this, they can't be in office. And then Section 3 actually supports that to say, hey, if you don't do what I'm saying and you can't prove me wrong that you have the authority within the Constitution to do this, then either you fix this or you're gone because they won't leave. They right. won't leave because these men have no honor. They have no integrity. These are creatures of self-preservation of their own evil. And so the other option that we have to use to actually invoke this, which is another thing that has been marginalized and actually is non-functioning, is the common law court and common law grand jury. Because,
and so,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Okay, because I think what I was saying as we broke into the break, and I didn't get to hear your comments because of that, was that originally, you know, people think of common law as the common law grand jury is what the rights that people had in England, but they had a monarch. We still have that, but it's our representatives at the county level that have the authority and actually the responsibility to call a common law grand jury, and they don't even know it.
Right. So you're bringing up a very specific view or paradigm. Very specifically, if we're going to restore our common law and our common law courts to invoke common law grand juries, we must take control of our counties and have our county representatives do this.
So they have the power, they have the authority, they're just not using it, and I bet most of them don't even know it's available.
Right.
Wow.
That is correct. So in other words, this is the whole, I'm shining the light on how successful evil has become in America. Because these very essential things that are a part of the supreme law of the land, common law courts, and the common law grand jury, as well as the oath, the petition, and Section 3, put them all together, folks, and now you can actually start forcing people out. So what did they have to do? They had to get us to not understand these things, to marginalize them, and get us to ignore them. And now we're screaming at the top of our heads, this is all you've got to do. You can take your government back if you do these very specific things.
Well, here.
And these things will lead us to Republic Review, to taking and forcing the federal government into compliance. It all falls into place. It's like these are the dominoes. You knock this, you start using petitions, create a movement to demand that your county commissioners do their job in supporting the Constitution. Because if you have county commissioners that are supporting the Constitution, they're going to give you the common law grand jury. They're going to actually stand that up, and your common law grand jury is going to indict your state legislator and have that person removed. Because right here, they have the power. It's saying right here, the inferior courts have the power to do that by invoking the supreme law. And then and technically, because of Section 3, they can't appeal it. It's not appealable. You're no longer eligible to be in office, and you'll be stricken from ever being, you know, even on a ballot in this county.
It's not even, because it's not even considered a right.
Correct. There's an eligibility standard that you have to meet. And if you violated your oath, you have now, you know, crossed the line and are now banished, because that's what it says in Section 3, that they can no longer have an office, be a public officer. And, you know, this, in other words, they're to be banned.
Whoa. Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, people. Yeah, so there seems to be a lot of people that say, "Is there something we can do with these politicians?" Yes, but you have to understand that the only way you're going to be able to do this is you've got to convince everybody that, you know, we have to take this power back ourselves at the county level, and we can do it. Right.
Wow. Okay. All right. That is awesome. Okay, so we just finished up with Mr. Governor Johnston.
Well, right? So correct, but actually there's another note under Governor Johnston. So if you click on that note, my bad. We did cover that. So we go down to the note under McLean, which takes us down to page 36, yes.
Okay, McLean. There it is. All right. The president is a superior officer who is to see the laws put in execution. He is amenable for any maladministration in his office. Were it possible to suppose that the president should give wrong instructions to his deputies, whereby the citizens would be distressed, they would have redress in the ordinary courts of common law. But, says he, parties injured must go to the seat of government of the United States and get redress there. I do not think it will be necessary to go to the seat of the general government for that purpose. No persons will be obliged to attend there, but on extraordinary occasions, for Congress will form regulations so as to render it unnecessary for the inhabitants to go thither, but on such occasions. I think I understand what this is saying, that if the people have grievances against the president, for example, that they shouldn't be forced to have to go to the seat of the general government.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And so that's what he says, redress in ordinary courts of common law, that would be in the counties. It doesn't say that specifically, but that's based on what we just discussed.
Right. Yes.
That would take this to.
Okay. Right? So the other thing that the evil one would have to actually convince you is that your voice is in the national arena. In other words, when we look today at how much talk goes on and on about an engaging, directly engaging the federal government or the general government, the reality is we should actually be engaging our state legislatures and our county commissioners to say, hey, you know, why are you letting the federal government doing these things? But instead, we completely ignore our local government who has the authority to control them. And we think that we can go in there by our bitching and moaning and could do a better job. And the evidence, the empirical data proves that it won't work. That what we've been doing is a failure. We actually have to empower those who have the authority, which is the state legislature. They have the power. We have to get them to use it.
What we've been doing continues to be a failure. And the brilliantly sinister thing is they continue to encourage us to appeal to the general government.
To directly engage them. Correct.
Right.
You know, because that's, you know, when you see a monster, when you see the grizzly bear or what have you, you know, there's actually layers of protection that they're there. They may not be visible to you because your eyes are focused. You know how when you start looking at something and you're focused in a distance, everything else becomes a blur.
Right.
And so you don't see that, oh, you know, there's this huge guard there. There's this wall that we call our state government. But I see the bear on the top of that hill and I'm ignoring the wall in between me and that bear. And what I do is I go and engage that bear and I bypass that wall.
Right, because you don't recognize it. You don't recognize it as a barrier or a protection.
And then I get ravaged by the bear because we, the people, you know, have ignored the wall and marginalized it so it doesn't exist.
Correct.
It's not that it's not there. It's just that we've actually built these bridges to go around, you know, to either go around or go over these things that are actual obstructions to keep the government from being able to do these things. And it's our fault. We're the ones that have allowed ourselves to say, oh, we can do a better job. Are you kidding me? There's no evidence that we're doing a better job. A democracy can be literally manipulated. And that's what we're seeing. They're proving that they have full control over us. Go ahead.
Right. That is the beauty of a Republican form of government and not a democracy.
Right.
Right.
There you go.
That is. I thought I understood this. And this has been eye-opening. Even
okay.
now.
Okay. All right. So when we go down a little bit further, we find common law and the militia. Now, this is Mr. McLean, and Mr. McLean is obviously he's a Federalist, and he's a pretty smart guy. Him and Mr. Iredell, I think, are the really two strong orators that really make a great case. But unfortunately, it wasn't enough to get them to pull the trigger. And so now pulled the trigger in ratifying the Constitution.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so we're down on page 46 with common law and the militia. And this is kind of a long one, so go ahead and get started. And you should probably be able to get all of this through because we got about 7.5 minutes to go.
I think we can do that.
Okay.
So this is Mr. McLean.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, the Reverend gentleman from Guilford has made an objection which astonishes me more than anything I have heard. He seems to be acquainted with the history of England, but he ought to consider whether his historical references apply to this country. He tells us of triennial elections being changed to septennial elections. This is an historical fact we well know, and the occasion on which it happened is equally well known. They talk as loudly of constitutional rights and privileges in England as we do here, but they have no written constitution. They have a common law, which has been altered from year to year for a very long period. Magna Carta, and Bill of Rights. These they look upon as their constitution. Yet this is such a constitution as it is universally considered Parliament can change. Blackstone, in his admirable commentaries, tells us that the power of the Parliament is transcendent and absolute and can do and undo everything that it is not naturally impossible. The act, therefore, to which the Reverend gentleman alludes was not unconstitutional. Has any man said that the legislature can deviate from this constitution? The legislature is to be guided by the Constitution. They cannot travel beyond its bounds. The revered gentleman says that though the representatives are to be elected for 2 years, they may pass an act prolonging their appointment for 20 years or for natural life without any violation of the Constitution. As is it possible for any common understanding or sense to put this construction upon it? Such an act, sir, would be a palpable violation of the Constitution. Were they to attempt it, sir, the country would rise against them. After such an unwarrantable suggestion as this, any objection may be made to this Constitution. It is necessary to give power to the government. I would ask the gentleman who is so much afraid it will destroy our liberties, why is he not as much afraid of our state legislature? For they have much more power than we are now proposing to give this general government. They have an unlimited control over the purse and sword, yet no complaints are made. Why is he not as much afraid that our legislature will call out the militia to destroy our liberties? Will the militia be called out by the general government to enslave the people, to enslave their friends, their families, themselves? The idea of the militia being made use of as an instrument to destroy our liberties is almost too absurd to merit a refutation. It cannot be supposed that the representatives of our general government will be worse men than the members of our state government. Will we be such fools as to send our greatest rascals to the general government? We must both be fools as well as villains. Excuse me. We must be fools as well as villains to do so. Okay, he's just very colorful is not the word, but very descriptive. He's responding to this argument.
Okay, so bottom line, this really kind of lays out the jurisdiction that, you know, if it's not something that is actually delegated, because he actually gives a very good view for the people that they really don't have a constitution. What they have is a Bill of Rights that keeps the government from being able to mess with these very few things. Everything else is covered by, you know, the discretionary powers. If it's not protected, then they can do it. Well, to be honest with you folks, go look at Britain today. go look at the laws that they're invoking and the tyranny that the people of Britain or England and its empire is being, you know, subjected to. And you'll find that many of them are violations of their rights. What the heck happened? As a matter of fact, go ahead.
When you speak of England, I want you to know I've got a lot of friends in Canada that are, you know, it's part of their empire.
Right.
Really angry. Uh-huh. Now, there's a movement in Alberta to become one of the United States.
Yes. I mean, that would be so. What would happen is they would need to get the entire nation. It would be good, you know, but here's the problem. Mm-hmm. Mexico is divided into states as well.
Right.
And so we really need, you know, because the last thing we want is to have small states come in and then become a sovereign state without, mm-hmm. you know, because bottom line, if Canada came in as its own state, then it would get two senators. But if all of the states of Canada come in as independent states, then they would get their own two senators and representation by the states. If you're following my projection here, when we start bringing in so Canada may not be that big of a threat ideologically, but you have to slowly bring in these other nations and allow them as a territory and then bring them in as a state and then allow them to subdivide as they are, you know, able to truly conform, you know, to this new government. Because bottom, what ends up happening is it's kind of like if you let every island in the Pacific Islands become a state, like Hawaii. See, Hawaii is a cluster of islands. With the Pacific Islands should be a single state,
mm-hmm.
instead of each island being a state. And it's kind of like with Mexico and some and Latin America. Do we really want and believe that the plight of the people in Latin America is that uniquely different? Are those really more counties than Latin America itself?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, let's say, you know, we bring in Honduras and then Guatemala and El Salvador and these other nations actually come in. They should be incorporated into the state of Latin America or whatever.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because they would be incorporated as a county or a sub-element.
Right.
Right.
You don't want to be... So the understanding of a Republican form of government is pretty well, if we use it, is pretty well can be entrenched. But if you overwhelm the 50 states with, imagine, 50 other states mm-hmm. that don't understand this concept,
yep.
their standard.
And there we go.
We
So, Paul, unbeknownst to you, you can't hear what I'm saying because the music's playing. We actually just ran out of time. But you're right. You hit the nail on the head. We cannot allow, you know, the watering down of the culture and the paradigms of our principles. So I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. We'll be right back with more North Carolina.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.